Okay, everybody, we'll get started. Today is July 23rd, 2015. My name is Gary Corbett. And in honor of my late father, Ted Corbett, and the many other pioneer long-distance runners and race officials, including Donna Gookin, Sarah Mae Berman, and Vince Chiappetta, who are on this call today, I'm working to document and preserve the history of all facets of the sport of running. Today is the first of a series of conference calls to highlight the early women pioneers of ultramarathon running. We have a panel today of five ladies who will be featured in an audience of running pioneers and people interested in preserving running history. The format is that we'll have the panelists talk for approximately 5 minutes, and then we'll open things up for questions and comments for another 10 minutes, and then go on to the next panelist. So, Ann Trayson, we'd like to start with you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right.
Let someone else go first, please. Yeah, if that's okay. Is that okay?
That's fine. Donna. Donna, we'll start with you. Donna Gookin.
Hi, Gary. I want to thank you for making this possible, and for being the son of the great Ted Corbett, who legitimized the distances we would run, besides being a great runner himself. I want to thank the people that influenced me, especially President Kennedy, who emphasized fitness, Jack LaLanne for telling kids to go get mommy so she could come exercise, and who suggested that maybe we could run or walk around the house during the commercials. After I thought I could do that, I thought maybe I could even run for an hour in the house and go outside on the streets. Before that, I was just sprinting up our street when someone was watching the kids, and I got terrible shin splints. It was the size of golf balls, and now they're on my heels. But thank you to all those who adventured into the running scene back east, Bobby Gibb, Nina Kuschick, Sarah Berman. They were really instrumental in getting us motivated when the word would trickle out. And I met Lynn Carman, who was the wife of Bob Carman, a runner, and she said she had three children and had run 5 miles. I thought, my gosh, I will try to do something like that someday. But I also wanted to mention Dr. Boyer and Fred Cash out here who put running on the map for healing even people with heart attacks. And they started a class here, and they had the firemen in town taking that kind of workout, and I got to lead a group first as a volunteer, and I when they thought they would start that in San Diego, and so I knew quite a bit about running, being in a running family, and having had also a fitness group called Turner Inc., where I would do hula hoops, ball routines, all kinds of dancing, and would bring that into the class. So I had a class where the children would be in the play yard right next to the grass where us gals would be running. And we got some good publicity with people coming from local papers and saying, what is this, this outlandish thing that women are running? I can't believe it. And so they put it in the paper. And our local AAU chairman said, after I couldn't get any word to go ahead with women's running here in town, I had written to Neil Jackson, who was the long distance, who was the women's AAU chairman, and asked her if we could have women running in some of the runs here in town. And she says there's not enough women running 2 miles on the track yet to warrant having them run anything longer. Ralph Smith was very good because he said, well, you know, there's a little outlet there. You can do cross country. So why don't you do a series of development runs so that you can publicize that women have done these 3 mile cross country runs. So I did that. And then I had a run where we started 1 mile up the street from the guys running the 10K so we wouldn't jeopardize their AAU standing. At that time, they thought that if anybody ran that wasn't a member of the men's AAU, they could possibly disqualify all the men. So we started our run 1 mile up the road, and the men got in there with the gals, and the gals loved it. The men loved it, too. So it was wonderful. Anyway, I ran a marathon in 1971 along with one of the children of our family, family track club members, and she was 12 years old, Carolyn McDonald, and I went on to run 40 marathons. I won 10 of those marathons in the women's division, and I went on to do 5 50-mile runs, 4 on the track in Culver City, in Santa Monica, excuse me, the SPAAU division. By that time, Ken Foreman had been selected in women's long-distance running chairman, and he okayed us to go ahead. I wrote him a letter, and he answered back that it was all right with him, and just to be sure we were in good health and to go ahead with his recommendations to do it. So that was great. And so let's see, what else should I say? Oh, good. Thomas Durek, of course, was in the Striders that put on these 50-milers at Santa Monica. And Eileen Waters, one of my dear running buddies, was in the first one in 1973, and she urged me, and so did Tom, to do it the next year, and I did. And in one of those runs, I was, in fact, two of those runs, I was the first woman in them. But in the one that Eileen won, I set 12 track records, world track records. But she won the race because she started out with a very slow pace, around a 9:30 or so. And I was starting out at the pace I wanted to maintain for the entire thing. I think one of the thrilling things I had in my running career, too, was that I got to go to the first World Masters meet in Toronto that Dave Payne had developed. And I won the marathon in that race. I was ahead of Ruth Anderson, a great runner, and some others. And I was first woman in the first World Masters. Then 2 years later, they had more women. I was in Sweden, in Gothenburg, and I was third in my division because there were so many more women. Then in 1979, I went on to the next World Masters, and I was fifth in my division, but by then there were so many more women that we had a team award, and Mickey Gorman, Nikki Hobson, and I were the second-place team in our division. So that was a thrill to have a first from Toronto, a third from Sweden, and a second place medal in the team in Hanover, Germany. Okay, does anybody want to say anything?
Okay, we can. That's beautiful, Donna. Let's open things up to questions for Donna.
Donna, this is Mitch Chiappetta. Can I ask you a personal question?
Certainly.
How did Gukeneg develop from your sweat or your husband's?
when my husband went over to Alamosa to run with Billy Mills, they tried the drink that they had there and they didn't like it. And Bill, being a chemist, he worked with somebody with the zoo and developed Gukeneg, and I helped to weigh it out and seal the packages here, and we sent it out, 3 packages for $1. And and my husband now, Edwin, who I've been married to for almost 30 years, was very happy to use Gukeneg. In fact, he and I both won at Salt Lake City, and we put out our Gukeneg on the course, as did Eileen Waters. And so they had Gatorade, but we did it with our Gukeneg. And so Bill is nearby. He's in assisted living, and we see him often. And he's still doing a little orienteering. My husband Edwin and I won in Kamloops, Canada, Kamloops, B.C., in 1998 in the World Super Vet division of a 24-hour Rogaine. So that was a thrill to be able to put our running to work on that, too. So anyway, did that answer the question?
Well, that was great. Yeah, no. I remember we had these jokes about who Sweaty was taking out to examine.
Yeah.
But by the way, mate, and if he still is viable, understand, his was the only drink that was biochemically valid for the processes of what it was made for. All the other ones were dangerous to people in the way they were made. Because they were all
too super saturated.
And so
with
it was just great what
sugar.
He did.
And what is your name so I can tell him?
Vincent Chiapetta.
What is your name?
Chiapetta.
Okay.
Vincent, yeah. From New York City.
Okay. Okay, thank you, and I will tell Bill, and we knew it was true. We told everybody that it had the least amount of sugar and the best amount of potassium and everything else.
Yeah. Right, just
thank
you. My company the best, yes.
For the callers, Gucanate predated or Gatorade and such items, drinks. Other questions, comments for Donna?
Donna, this is Sarah Mae Berman.
Well, Sarah.
Hi. Haven't seen you in a while.
I hope to see you at the next orienteering at Tahoe coming up in September.
When did you start orienteering?
Well, that's been a long time ago, too, Sarah, because the Marines introduced it to our track club, and that was, it was way, way back. It must have been
in the
45, 70s. 50 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
How long for you? We started.
Well, we went to a lecture in Boston about it in 71, and then actually entered the two meets that were available in 72.
I'm sure that we had been doing it then too, even before maybe. I know that I did break my leg and dislocate my ankle in the last part of 74. Up at a meet at Palomar that we had. And so I'm glad I did my best 50, which was 712 in in the early part of 74.
Well, you know, you're quite an exception. I've never heard of anybody having such problems orienteering before. We've had people and our own experience running on a road and falling down and spraining ankles and so on, but not in the woods. So your experience is not typical.
I was coming down a steep mountain, and I thought, oh, no, there's a three-hour time limit, and this is the first time I've tried the red course. I've got to get in. So I sprinted across the meadow, and my leg twisted on one of those shiny humps of grass and
broke that
leg and then pulled out my ankle. But I'm still orienteering. We just did it in Idaho recently.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We do it
on
the beach,
too.
Donna, you mentioned...
I beg your pardon, Gary.
Yeah, you mentioned a Dr. Boyer, a Fred Cash. Who were they in terms of influencing you?
Dr. Cash was a PE instructor over at San Diego State, and Dr. Boyer, who was a heart specialist, joined with him to figure out a program for people with heart problems, and they had discovered that people that had heart problems recovered much better if they were on an active program of walking and jogging. And that was publicized, and that was the start I always thought anything where I huffed and puffed must be terrible for me. After reading that, I had no excuses. Look up Dr. Boyer and Dr. Cash, especially John Boyer, B-O-Y-E-R. And in 1969, I took a class from Dr. Boyer. It was called Hypokinetic Disease and Why. It's because of people having their heredity, their diet, their smoking, their weekend athletes, and all that, you know. And so Dr. Boyer and Dr. Fred Cash are good to look them up. And also we were tested by Dr. Wilmore up at Davis and Dr. Tuni Susek here and up at Tahoe to see our O2 uptake, and that could compare different people and show that the people in the best shape, if they had good lungs, were going to be taking in more oxygen much faster.
Donna, what years were you in high school and college?
I was in college in 54 through 1956, and then I went back to college.
Okay, so you're roughly my age then, because
I think we're the same age there.
Yeah, in public school, when I was going to high school and college, there weren't really sports for girls.
No,
and running was not something
softball.
That was known at all.
No, they thought they were really prejudiced against people doing anything that was unladylike or something like that. I mean, except in class, we did our dancing and we did softball, little basketball,
half court.
Right.
Yeah, and field hockey, a field hockey thing for women too, that went on.
That came later, unless you were in private school.
Yeah.
But
so
I love to race out there. Excuse me, Gary.
Go ahead.
That's Vince. Go ahead, Vince.
At that time, in the phys ed departments were being taught that the angle of the thigh with the hip of a female was counteractive to any successful athletic careers, and that it would be damaging for all sorts of things. And I remember having to fight these battles in those days too, because I knew more about the physiology and biology than they did. But they would just make these things out of the old, and that was 1890 statements made in England to prevent women from doing anything, and that hung on a long time. Of course, it was all wrong, and it's just so because the woman's leg compensated by the angle of touch. So gradually that disappeared. That took a long time. I mean, when you think about it, you're talking about 54. In the 70s, there were still phys ed departments saying this stuff. So it was pretty horrible.
Well, not only was
they wouldn't listen to them.
Not only was it unfeminine, it was dangerous to your reproductive systems.
Oh, that's right.
The
and they think you wouldn't menstruate if you did that. Yeah, that's right.
You couldn't have babies.
That was,
I mean,
that was a common feeling, though.
Yeah, oh, yeah, with the bouncing of the uterus. That's what they were worried about. And of course, the bladder bounces more than the uterus ever bounces. So, I mean, we should be all incontinent by now. But those were things very hard to break, because once I get into a textbook, it's very hard to break them down, and even now there are things in medical textbooks that are totally incorrect, but they keep putting them in there and they keep getting repeating them. I mean, you got to constantly educate people about certain things, and I think it's
and
people
course,
like us that get involved in these things do something about it.
And of course, if a woman did long distance running and was dehydrated, it would be very likely she might not have her menstrual period, and that would keep up this myth about women and their reproductive systems, you know. So a person did need to be rehydrated all the time.
And there was an element of anorexia, too, to some women who took up sports. And that
true.
Was very unknown at that time. And that a little bit of that was built up into a huge problem, which was for everybody. But that was naturally a psychological thing. And, of course, we did make a lot of anorexic women in the 70s about keeping the weight down, which was totally a bad news thing also.
That's true.
It's still a problem. Hand raised in here. I coach middle school, and it's still a huge issue that we deal with boys and girls.
Let's move on. We can come back to some of this. This is obviously a great discussion. Lou Payton, you're up next, please.
Okay. Thank you. So I think that in Arkansas, ultra running came around here a little bit later than, say, the West Coast. I started running in 1968 when my son was born, and started with a half mile and worked, ran like a half mile, worked up to 5 miles. I did that for 5 years. I'd run 5 days a week. I just got really hooked on it for the mental refreshing feeling that I got, and totally hooked on it. And then I started hearing about some races that YMCAs were having. Now, it would be rare, but say 2 races a year. And I'll have to mention a couple of names. Max Hooper was one of the first ultra runners here, first marathoners. We all talked about the Boston Marathon. That was the highest goal then, was to be able to go to Boston. And so Max Hooper, Otis Edge, Gary Smith were some of the very first runners here going to Boston. And other people, myself included, started joining in to do training runs with them. I was not the first Arkansas woman to run the Boston Marathon. Pat Torvastat was, and she was running back in 1979 and 80. And I worked for 8 years to get to go to the Boston Marathon, and it was worth every single step to get there. Just injuries came my way or something prevented me from going until 1985. And it was wonderful. And so when I came home from running the Boston Marathon, Max Hooper gave me a call and told me that he was going to a race called Western State in California.
Yes.
And he invited me to go and be a crew member and possibly a pacer for him. And several other people were going on that trip. When I got there and during the race, I was in total awe of Helen Klein, and I met Susie Pope during the event and just watched her with a group of 8 men trailing behind her, and it was just the most inspiring thing I'd ever seen. And, you know, I just wanted to go back. Max did not finish that year. I think he got to Michigan Bluff. But something just happened that we came back and talked about nothing but Western States and 100-milers and ultra running. And we had a few shorter races going on around Little Rock, one called the Scenic Maumelle 60K, which was run on pavement, and it also was a qualifier. Well, I know one person did get to qualify for Western States using that race with the race officials adding some mileage to it because you had to qualify to go to, yeah, to go to Western States. And so someone did extend just for that person and had the officials, you know, but he did it. But
right.
It was so exciting. I just get excited thinking about it now. So I don't know if you have more questions or get me back on track, but that's how I got introduced, was to go to California and see grandmothers finish 100 miles. And I just came back talking about it.
When you first, this is Vincent Chiappetta. When you first started, what did your neighbors say about you running around?
Well, you know, you were certainly an oddball. At that time, there were only three women in Arkansas that I knew of that ran at all. And that we had a goal. You know, one was trying to get in shape to go snow skiing, and she was, that was Pat Torvastat. I just was totally hooked on it mentally, just for what it did for me. It just made me feel good, and I didn't worry about anything. If I could get my run in, everything else took care of itself. And then I would hear that there's a woman who runs in Texarkana, Arkansas. So, you know, we'd hear of people one at a time who had taken up running. And then the goal was to meet that person and share knowledge and Any article I could find in Parade magazine about someone who ran, I have those articles.
Well, you know what you expressed is it was everywhere, even when we got going in New York with these things. So it was not a unique thing. Women and Stewart, many things are looked in askance over these things. But that's why every place started. People like yourself, and then encouraging each other and then hearing about somebody else and so forth. When Nina Cusick went to Puerto Rico for a race they had down there, she was the only woman in the race, and they asked her to say some words. So she said some words to the women that every one of them should be running next year when they're here. The men took the microphone away from her because we don't want our women to run. So all the women came out to her. So next year, a whole bunch of women were there to run. It was very, very cute. It was a beautiful history.
Gary Corbett has done a real service to the early women running, because when we were all beginning, not knowing whether we were the only ones or whether we were oddballs or what, there was no internet, and we were all scattered all over the place. We might have heard of each other, but it was only rarely when we got to run against each other.
That is so
true,
Sarah.
Part of that was Ted's job. Ted did a lot of communicating about these things, too. I mean, he had a huge following of people who he contacted. And every time something happened, he sent out information all over the country, which was an encouragement to many areas of the area and even of the world. So Gary's father was a really very important part of this, too, and always encouraging people around getting information out, getting a result out, that we know about it and hear about your women and also the places when you didn't realize when we were finding out about it.
And Donna Gookin here. Joe Henderson, you know, Runner's World, promoting long, slow distance, LSD, I think that was a big incentive to a lot of women, too, you know, hearing about that. And of course, Western States 100, I've got to say, it was certainly an outstanding run, and I worked with several people that were training for that. And boy, what a thrill that would be to do any of it. I'm just glad, of course, that they didn't have hundreds when I was running.
You might have done it, see that?
Right.
Other questions for Lou? Comments? Questions?
What did your family think, Lou?
Lou who? Who, Lou? He's gone.
Lou, you still on, Lou?
Lou,
might have got disconnected. Maybe I have to call back in.
Okay.
Lou, you're on?
Who's next?
I might as well fill up the gap. Can I say, I'll say something. This is Donna Gookin.
Go ahead,
I want to say that, shall I go ahead, Gary?
Yes, go ahead, Lou. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I want to say that it was really optimal that I was able to work out with my husband, Bill. I mean, I was able to be present when he was working out with Carrie Whittaker, who was 10 times under 4 minutes for a mile on the track. I could have my children right there and see how they would do their sprints and everything. And then in Balboa Park, I got to be there with Billy Mills. And so I got to observe some of these fantastic men runners. And, of course, a lot of men were so supportive and so helpful in our early days, like Ken Bernard and of course, Tom Sturrock and Dave Payne and Augie Escamilla and lots of great guys.
All of them great guys. I knew them all. But talking about the families, in New York City, running... distance running would not have really even made it. And all our races involved the families of the runners who were part, who did all of the water stations, did everything that had to be done that we didn't have volunteers for, and that's how our races were able to develop, because the families were out there having so much fun, just enjoying it. The kids being out there handing you a cup of water, and without that, many areas of running would never even got going. It was for the positive actions that the wives, and then someone who got into running on their own then after that. It's a sport that's so unique in that type of thing. Where the whole family can be involved and participate.
Good point.
Yes, that is true.
Lou Payton, you back on?
Yes, I must have accidentally pushed a button and I got disconnected, yes.
Okay, good to know.
How did your family think?
Well, I was just an oddball, a total oddball, but it made me feel so good that I didn't care.
Good for you.
And, you know, we would go to a family reunion or a reunion back in Vicksburg, Mississippi, where Charlie and I are from, and I remember that the word was out back when I first started running that I could run a mile. One of our relatives said, Luke, it's running a mile. And by then, I was running 5 or so miles, but they could not believe that a woman could run a mile.
Right.
Which is odd. Yes. And I'm not sure where I got cut off, you know, when I was talking before about ultra running coming to Arkansas and how the races in California influenced us. I'm not sure where my phone cut off, but I just felt like we learned from what was happening in California and meeting Susie Cope and Helen Klein and then David Horton here in Arkansas running and his telling us about Old Dominion, and our world just kept enlarging, and the word was getting out, and then we started newsletters about running and where fun runs would be, and it was just such an exciting time. It was so exciting.
Great.
Lou, this is Vince Chiappetta. Can I ask you a question? Did you get more information from California in your state than you did of the Northeast?
Well, yes, and it could be because Max Hooper made the first trip to California, you know, to go to Western State. And that could be the reason.
Right. But also remember, I remember in those days going down south and the Middle West and so forth, and all I could read in the paper was how bad the Northeast was. So the papers were very positive about what we did up there anyway.
That's interesting. And at that same time, you know, the 24-48-hour races were big in the Deep South. Somehow we were drawn more to go west than until we found out about Old Dominion. That was how we started going east. But in the Deep South, people were running the 24-48-hour, even around, I've heard, a hangar at an airport, you know, that, and Gary
I remember those.
Yeah,
we heard about these things, but we just didn't really contact. They were very good.
We had 6-day runs here in San Diego that were put on, too.
Those days began the whole big thing about the 6-day runs all over the country. So they became very popular all over the country. So that was good. And the San Diego one grew out of the fact that someone ran one of the Eastern ones and thought it was a great thing and brought it out.
Any last comments and questions for Lou? Okay, thank you, Lou. Susie Cope?
Yes. You ready?
You're on, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. Hi, everybody. It's been fascinating listening to you so far. I hope I can help out with this. I'm pleased to be here, pleased to be included. But let me clarify, first of all, my name. It's Susie Clark was what my first married name was. That was what was listed in race results. Then it was Tebow, then Shearer, and finally my last married name is Cope. I had a severe knee injury accident on a motorcycle when I was 20, and I was unable to take up jogging or anything else until I was in my 30s. And my first introduction to distance running possibilities was during a private dinner party in the mid-70s when I was fortunate enough to meet Ruth Anderson. And She just ran that first women's marathon in Waldheim, Germany, and that was 1973. But I wasn't even running 5K at that point. I lived in Northern California, and I had the good fortune of meeting Sally Edwards, who had the original Fleet Feet store in Sacramento.
Yeah.
And she started a series called the Golden State Women's Series, which was a 10K road race series. And that was my goal for that year, and I wasn't particularly fast, but I won the division for the not real young, not real old, kind of in between, and that was in the spring of 1980. And I had the pleasure of pacing Sally Edwards during an epic night during her win, Western States, in 1980. I did training runs with her up on the course. And that gave me a lot of insight into the opportunity of running ultra distances. But at the time, I continued running, and I was racing an endurance horse in endurance rides in the early 80s. And I met Helen Klein after she had an unsuccessful first attempt at Western States. She moved to California, she and Norman. And since Helen did not drive, I offered to support her training, and so driving and running with her the spring prior to Western States 84, that gave me a lot more insight into Western States itself and also into an older woman than myself running and what she had had encountered at that point. I advised her as her new coach to enter the Nugget 50, which was a 50-mile endurance ride and run in the mountains near Sacramento. And I had ridden my horse in it the year before and was unable to complete the 50 with my horse. But I entered and ran with Helen, and that was my first 50-mile finish. So it was Helen's last training run for Western States. And I paced her during Western States, and she completed in 84. So that was educational for me and certainly memorable to Helen. And then as far as my own efforts on Western States, my inaugural 100 was Western States in 85, and I ran again in 86 and was only, I think, a second faster, and both of these were just barely under 30-hour cutoff. But I realized running trails, and especially running 100, was something that I could do. If I couldn't be fast, I could certainly do this particular thing, and that was the beginning of a long string of hundreds. I ran Old Dominion and ran with Lou Payton and Nick Williams, and that was in 87, which was, of course, meeting people from all over the U.S. was half of the fun, and I was certainly capable of talking most of the run. Did Wasatch in 87, delighted on that course, just loved it. And then in 88, I did Leadville and Angeles Crest. This mostly because I did not get drawn in Western States, so I could not make an attempt, which was my strongest desire, which was the Grand Slam. And that was orchestrated by Wasatch. So about this time, as you said, there was no internet. We subscribed to Ultra Running. We wrote letters that required stamps, by the way. I started a newsletter, and I called the newsletter Susie T's Trail 100's newsletter, and it was quarterly, and it was typed, it was stapled, it was unfortunately it cost postage, so I got donations from my subscribers. Total of 12 issues went out. I had 400 subscribers, and it was pure magic when it came to staying in touch with other women interested in trying to do the Grand Slam. And Lou Payton, who we've already heard from, was certainly one of the more important of those women. Helen Klein was another one. I think we're going to hear from Marge. I sure hope so. Anyway, there were six or seven women that signed on to try to do the Grand Slam in 89. We had a problem with it in that Old Dominion had just converted to a 24-hour cutoff, which was not what the Grand Slam was about. I lobbied the Wasatch Grand Slam board to offer the Vermont 100, which was brand new, as an alternative to Old Dominion, to try to avoid that 24-hour cutoff. And the board, unfortunately, John Grogan, was very reasonable about that, and they did change that so that we had the alternative to run Vermont. And those four of us that did manage to complete the Grand Slam that year all had opted for the Vermont option on that. So I completed the Grand Slam in 89 and added Angela's Crest on the end. Lou will never forgive me for that. As the first of the four to cross the line at Wasatch, I do consider myself the first woman to have completed the Grand Slam. And the race director, John Grogan, said it all at the finish line. He said, "Nobody can take that away from you." He's the sweetest man. But those of us that went on to do the Angela's Crest at the end, I think we overindulged ourselves, but it was fun. And Lucy and I had a ball on that one. She carried me at the finish, I swear. Anyway,
How old were you?
How old were you
in the 80s?
Child. I'm going to say I was 45, but I didn't quit at that point. I went on to run inaugural hundreds after that, and what I did, I tried to pick, you know, what was new. I went to the Barclay in 1990 and was the first woman to finish the what was called the Fun Run. Nancy Hamilton and I finished together, and I unknowingly reached over and touched a fence post and was awarded the win. So that's how that played. I also did the first Mohican 100, and the same year I ran sub-30 at Wasatch, which Anne can tell you isn't very fast, but that was, as far as I was concerned, my penultimate 100. And a little bit of trivia along that line, there was a run outside of Phoenix area that was called the Bloody Basin, and this was in 94 and 95. The first year it was won by a woman outright, Susan Gimble, and the next year I won it and ran it in sub-24 hours.
My goodness.
You just got to look for trivia. In total, I ran over 30 100-mile finishes, all trail, and the beast that slowed me the most was Hard Rock. It took me 5 tries to get that one done. My last 100 was Mapanutin in 2002, and so I do not claim to run ultra distances anymore, but certainly the number of 100-mile trail races has increased far beyond my imaginings. I feel that's all good. Certainly buyer beware, but I would encourage any long-distance trail running to use that 100 as a goal. Certainly how I feel about it. And there's my say. I'd love to hear from all of you regarding that.
Question for Susie?
Donna Gookin. Susie, do you know Dale Sutton? He's our local dentist, and he ran all those runs, too. And, of course, that Barclay was really the one that was talked about a lot. And I wonder if you know him. You do know him. Good.
He
had some AFib right now, but he's been a wonderful inspiration to us here in San Diego with all his long-distance runs. And I'm wondering if you know of any woman that has done the Death Valley to up Mount Whitney.
I do. I've known women from the very beginning of that particular event. I knew the first few guys that did it. I'm a close friend of Badwater Ben. So if you have any questions about Badwater, Ben's the guy to talk to.
Okay. And, of course, Dale.
Of course.
Yeah.
Susie, you mentioned, this is Gary, you mentioned the newsletter. Do you still have copies of that newsletter?
I do, and you can well imagine that they are on white paper, typewritten with the photographs taped on them.
Good.
Congratulations, by the way, on a wonderful career there.
Yeah.
What are you doing
you.
Now with yourself?
Mostly.
What are you doing now, Susie?
Mostly scuba diving, sailing. I still run trails a couple of times a week, but very short distance. But I do compete internationally in dog agility.
Boy.
What kind of dog?
I have miniature poodles, but the competition, whether you're running a border collie or a miniature poodle, you are the one that knows the course, and you have to run to get that information to your dog. So
yeah,
I'm running short sprints.
Well, I am now playing golf, and I always thought that was a whim sport. I used to think, what are those people doing just standing out there hitting the ball? But now I think, boy, it's a pretty good exercise, even jumping out of the cart to go hit my ball and just going back into it. I enjoy it a lot.
Susie, what makes up the Grand Slam?
Originally, the Grand Slam, which was, by the way, begun by the board that put Wasatch together, John Groban and his selected people put it together. Steve Baugh was also one of the primary instigators of that. And in the beginning, it was Western States, Leadville, Old Dominion, and Wasatch was the last, of course, chronologically, and also did the award. And when I finished Wasatch the first time, I saw the award. I watched Tom Green and Herb Tanzer and John Bandor receive the award. The trophy was a male runner, and
oh,
I told John Groban, I told John he needed to change the trophy design because I was coming back, and he believed me because the year that the four of us women finished, it was an eagle.
Good. At least something you couldn't
they
tell
could
which
put bumps
which
in the male runner.
Yeah, we had to change our medals a little bit down here too, San Diego. They're all men figures.
Other questions for Susie or comments? Will Marge Hickman could not join us today, so you mentioned Marge's name. One of the things that, and we can talk about this as we continue on, but just I'm curious, just your take on the sport, how it's evolved, and how you're feeling about the sport of ultra running, how it's changed, and any concerns you have and suggestions you have for its further development. And Tracy, we can come to that as we're going along, and maybe at the end we can wrap up with that question too. And Tracy,
wow, this is quite an honor to be included with such a great group of women. Thank you. I am started running because I always ran, but that I can remember. My mom put bells on my shoes, my first shoes, because she never could find me. So, and my brother was kind of a couch potato, so it was very difficult for them to have an active child. Although my brother was very active when he slept, and I just kind of fell asleep and didn't move. But now there was a very good mentor, John and Jim Heisman, started a age group cross track team. I have no idea. I'd love to find them. Because there was no track or cross country for girls, I was pre-Title IX just as it was getting accepted. They were my great mentors. They provided an access for a lot of us girls in the Monterey Bay area where I grew up to run. And my dad saw an ad in the paper and said, wow, this is something she can do. And he took me down there, and I was just very, very fortunate to have people like that, people come into your lives like them, and people like Ted Corbett and Nelson Mandela were my really big idols. And running, for me, it really has opened my life and allowed me to meet people that I would never have had the chance to meet, a lot of you people, or and also people like Ted came to a race I was doing in Flushing Meadows and taught me a wedding anniversary cake one year when I was running. It was so sweet. It was dark, and for him to remember that was very many tears were drawn that night.
And
the idea that I live right now in the Bay Area, in California. I grew up in the Monterey Bay Area because my mother got a PhD in 1958 from UC Berkeley and was a marine biologist. And there's a marine mammal, a marine center near the aquarium in Monterey. She was a very inspiring person. She also got a master's in early 50s at Stanford. No, she was the only woman in her class, so I guess she's always been someone I've looked up to. And unfortunately, she passed very early in my running life. She did get to see me finish Western States.
Oh.
But anyway,
she
sorry.
Must know.
Every time I think,
I
she
know.
Heard of Western States
know.
Before. She heard of Western States before I did. She taught community college, and there was a guy there, Bobby Yee, who had gone through the Vietnamese War and was going to go to podiatry school and start a running store. And when I ran AR, I did it because I never heard of it, anyone running that far, and I saw it in Competitor magazine, and I idolized Sally Edwards, and I heard she was going to be at American River 50, so I jumped at the chance and put my entry in. But when I finished, the thing I remember most was hearing about Western States. And I called my mom, and she says, "Are you alive?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm alive, but I'm never doing that again." It was horrible. It was really hot, miserable. And, "Mom, there's things they do further." And she said, "You haven't heard of Western States, I hope." And I was like, "Why have you?" And she told me about Bobby. And I was like,
"Yeah."
She says, I really didn't want you to hear about it. My mom always tried to protect me from things, so... she says, I was worried if you'd hear about it, you'd want to do it. And she thought it was too far. But it took a couple more mentors of mine to get me on the Western States Trail. And sometimes just one moment in your life can change your life. And running the first 30 miles of the Western States Trail with a good friend of mine, Aaron Warnham, changed my life. I decided it took him 6 months to get me on the first 30 miles of Western States, and once I did that first 30 with Aaron, my life changed. And my mother supported it, even though when I got to mile 30, I didn't finish the first two times. She saw me not finish those. The third time I got to a Forest Hill, she sat me down in a chair and she said, "You don't look good." She called me Doll or Beloved. And she said, "Doll, you look terrible. You've run far enough. I think we should just go home." But those are my favorite moments. I mean, talking about the slam, probably the thing that I remember most. I did it once because I heard what Susie did. I thought it was and Dick Collins. He was a big mentor of mine. That tells you that most of the people who were running back then were men.
Yes.
But the biggest thing out of the slam I got was I found my little Wasatch dog that just passed away about 5 weeks ago. But I found a little dog marking the course with the organizers when I was doing the slam of Wasatch. And another moment when you pick up something, it changes your life. So having Wasatch in my life and meeting people like Ted and getting that opportunity to shake the hands of Nelson Mandela. I mean, where did that come from? It was just too special.
Right.
So, that's about, if you have any questions, I'm usually pretty shy about talking about Monroe.
Questions, comments, Ann?
Ann, how old were you in the middle 80s?
Well, I ran in sixth grade. I was 11, 12?
Yeah.
So I was in the mid-80s. I was 20. I was born in 1960. So, I was in my mid, when I first did American River. I was about 25 when I did my first, 24, 25 when I did my first 50-miler, American River 50. There weren't many, I'll tell you. I had never heard of it. I couldn't believe anyone ran that far. I thought that was crazy.
I did the American River also. It was late in my running career. I was pretty doggone slow. It was around 9:25 or something. But I think Sally Edwards was the winner that year that I did it. And I don't know what year it was, because I would say it was probably about 77 or so. When did you run yours?
Year, what direction did you go? Because they used to, when they first started...
Oh, we started from Auburn.
We started from Auburn.
And went ways west, down the river. Is that the direction went to?
Well, when I did it from Sacramento to Auburn, but they changed the course
because things have gotten so
popular.
They had to go uphill.
Oh my goodness! When I did that hill, saw that hill, my pacer. I had someone who was pacers. And when I first started, which 19 miles to go, he said, "Why are you going so slowly?" And we got to that hill. It was a very hot day. He sat in the chair. And I won't say the French word. He was cussing up a storm. I'm not kidding. And he's like, "I'm not running up that hill, Anne." And he sat in the chair. It took him about 2 hours to get up.
Oh boy!
I still joke
around.
What year
was it you ran it?
1985.
What year did you run it? 85.
No, the first year I ran it in 1985. You know, after I got on that first 30 miles of Western States, I thought American River was totally boring. I did it three other times, but
yeah,
I love trails. So
You would have loved the Pacific Crest Trail 50 we had down here in San Diego that went from near Mexico up way up to Julian and back. It was a real good
race. Well, that's a comment I have for a lot of people is I've run that. I mean, there's all sorts of, one of the things I love doing is, and I still do it, is kind of what I call adventure running. I never do, it's something for everyone, the fastest known record stuff. I've done a lot. I just go out and run, and I saw that, your course down there, and one Christmas I went in with a friend, and we just ran it for fun. It was really cold.
Oh, great. I've run a lot of parts of it.
Yeah, so,
I used to
there's
train
a lot you
on
can
that.
Do that. Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful course.
Right. Of course, altitude running is the best workout you can get.
Yeah, it's and so close to an urban area was really special.
I wanted to say to Ann Trason that we were so thrilled when she signed up for the Arkansas Traveler 100, and we knew she was coming here. We never cashed her check. We still have it framed.
You never did.
Oh.
I was very hurt about that. I couldn't believe. Oh, I had such a good time there.
You should be honored.
Wonderful.
Oh, that
we
was. I had some great
here.
Stories. Oh, I still talk about the Traveler because it's just so great stories that I've had from going to Arkansas. Squirrel hunting season.
And this is Susie. I got to tell you where the Arkansas Traveler came from. It was during the time that Lou and I were out in the dark running the Grand Slam, and she said, "What will it take to get you to come to Arkansas and run?" And I said, "All you got to do is put on 100.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, that's what I was so addicted to hundreds after I did the slam. That's what I did. I was like looking around. There weren't a lot. I mean, now there's like over 200 of 100 milers, but in the day there were 7 when I started.
What kind of pace were you all running?
Slow.
Slow.
Yeah.
I mean, were you running 8 minutes a mile or 10 minutes a mile?
No, they're slower than that.
Right. You know, I think the winners would have run, say the male winner would have run 8 to 8.5 minute pace at the Traveler. But I think most people, it's one foot in front of the other, and just don't let yourself get down. Just be able to keep doing that.
I always tell people now the finish line stays still the same. Sorry.
I agree. The problem is these are all different kinds of running surfaces, and it just can't be about minutes per mile. It's about survival and what you do. And
that's
I don't think you can compare them.
Right.
Anne Iscariot, was the 100 your favorite distance, and what is some of your proudest accomplishments running wise?
Ooh, that's a hard one. Oh, I think being consistent. It's not one event. It was being able to come out and run 10 straight years at Western States, because it was never an easy race. I never had a good race. And then I had to take a year off. I was quite injured and came back. I guess also running Comrades, and then 10 days later running Western States. The second time I did it, I was really pushed at Comrades, which is by someone who ended up testing positive for steroids, which is something that, you know, unfortunately I feel like is in our sport these days. But I was pushed tremendously, and then having to get on an airplane the next day and fly 30 hours was tough mentally and physically. So I think just being able to even take that challenge is something I'll look proud of and hold in my hand. And
yes, boy.
What kind of training were you doing? How many miles a week were you running?
Oh, you know, that's how I got injured. People always ask me that. In the beginning, Chuck Jones was, you know, there wasn't much out there, and he was running 180 miles a week. So I said I had to run 180 miles a week. That was stupid. Sally Edwards, she interviewed me, and she said, that's stupid. And I was like, really?
Yeah.
But 100 miles a week were my doubt. If I ran less, I didn't feel good. So that was my staple of running diet. But talking about things I'm proud of, my last 100-mile finish was a couple years ago. I got talked into doing this Flagstaff. Ian Torrance, who's as they say, elite. I don't like that term, but they do it these days. Talked me into doing his 100, and then I finished second to last. I thought I was last. They let someone off the cutoff, and she had to run. Because I hiked, like, the last 40 miles. But I am so proud that I was able to struggle as I did and still finish in 29:45. Because the finish line, I thought I'd be embarrassed. I was in glad bags, and oh, my goodness, it was quite a sight. But I thought I'd be embarrassed, and I kissed that finish line and my crew, and I never had so much fun. We called ourselves Ultra Laugh because I was so pathetic. And I made so many mistakes, but it just got really cold and I was really dumb. But you know, the finish line really doesn't feel, to me, it doesn't feel any different, and I was very proud that I was able to stick it out, because I could have easily said, wow, you know, 29:45. You know, why do that? But I cherish that buckle, and I show the kids I coach that buckle more than my Western States buckle. I work for that one.
You got to wear jeans and put your buckle on, huh?
All right, this is Vince Keeper. May I ask a question? One thing I've noticed about the ultras as they've developed over the years is that it draws two types of people, those who are trying to prove that they can run as fast as they can, and then those who really get the joy out of it, that just the idea of going through it is such an exhilarating sense, and that you get the greatest enjoyment out of the accomplishment, as you said, Anne. And I think that's what's drawing people to it, and that means that many people who can't race fast can actually lope along beautifully and get a tremendous sense of accomplishment from it. And but you made a comment about steroids. Are people taking steroids because of joint problems or to enhance performance?
Oh, I was just using steroids, but I think there is quite a lot of it should be considered. It's been sort of swept under the carpet that there are performance-enhancing drugs that probably don't test much in ultra-running. And not that you'd have to be really dumb to get caught. That's my feeling.
Well,
Maria Bach tested positive right after the 100K in the late 90s. Sad moment, from probably the saddest moment I've ever had in ultra running. I dropped out of that race, but then for her to finish, Tom Johnson even said she was running like a man, and then she tested positive for testosterone, like really high.
Oh.
She said it was in her toothpaste. And the sad thing was that she still was considered a hero or heroine or whatever you want to call it in South Africa, and I thought this is something good should happen at this moment, and nothing, it just never was even addressed. And it was really sad.
Well, the hero aspect was that she did it and then got messed up with the drug aspects of it later. And this is because of people telling her that it make it better. But you realize, and I think that you ladies who have so much experience here, when you deal with younger people getting involved, all those drugs in the end increase your injury chances. They break down the joints ultimately, and you end up getting many more hip replacements. All sorts of things go wrong, and the funny thing about it is that the one drug that you could take that will benefit you is aspirin, and that would have helped support your cartilage and synovial fluid needs. In these long races. And another thing that's very important, and nobody does anymore, is that right after the race, to take a cold bath, sit in cold water, and this reduces the total inflammation plaques. And you'd be surprised how much recuperate. And you can't get people to even think this way. They think you're crazy. But that's the key to many of these things. And it reduces drug needs because the pain of the effort, which no matter what you do, you're going to get the pain of the effort, is reduced because of inflammation reduction. And it's an important element here. And you ladies can promote that because of your reputation, how good you are, and obviously the sense you showed in your competitions. Oh, another thing that I want to ask you, when you were a kid and you were running, at any point, did this begin to draw other young ladies in your neighborhood to come into running?
Who are you speaking to?
Anne. Didn't Anne say something about how to run by yourself?
Oh, thank you. And the person I got most into, well, it was more the girls that, I'll say girls because they probably were, that got me, because I ran on cross country in high school. And there was one woman that was a girl there.
Right.
Yeah, it was men's cross country. Yeah, my last year we did have a girls, but they changed the distance. And there's the Monterey High School. I was Pacific Grove. The Monterey High School guy still remembers. I protest. I can't believe I did this. But when we were made varsity girls, we were distance was cut in half because I liked running the 3 mile. And so I ran with the boys in one of the league meets. Because I protested and my coach allowed me to. And the other coach that we had the dual meet with, still to this day I see him and he's still mad at me. Because they fought so hard, you know, it's funny, they fought so hard to get the girls, get them varsity. And then here's little Anne saying, hey, no, I really want to run 3. You're only allowing us to do 2. So I'm going to go run 3 with the boys.
Right.
So there's 2 sides to everything. But the person I probably influenced the most, he's still running, is Greg Nako. It's funny. We used to have, like, runs high school against each other. And you wouldn't know him, but he's he ran Western States for 10th year this year. But, yeah, so he's a great guy.
Now, what year was this when you were doing this with the cross-country?
When
you were in high school, what year?
No, well, that was, I got him started when I started running with Jim and John Heiserman in 72.
But we already had Title IX in effect.
not in 72.
School implemented it. No.
It had dribbled down. It never occurred in a high school in those days. Yeah. I mean, it was really horrible that all that time of working on those changes in the law and so forth, that it didn't trickle down very quickly down to the lower school levels. They still used the same excuses of depriving the girls. It was a big battle all the way into the 80s. But that, you guys were great setting the example. It was wonderful.
And still is in some places.
It's really great to see the numbers of people doing the marathons here now. All the women, there's more women than men, and thousands and thousands and thousands. And I could see it progressing little by little, you know, every year. And I led classes in six different recreation centers where I brought in running along with other things, and also coached a cross-country team, and also got our San Diego Track Club to get third place in the California meet and have the first women's uniforms that we made ourselves. We got big applause for those.
That's nice. Very nice. Let's bring Chrissy Ferguson into the discussion. Chrissy, you have the floor.
Oh, hi there. My name is Chrissy Ferguson, and I have been running Ultra since 1992. My first Ultra was American River 50 also. I got into running because I was training to become a firefighter. And one of the things that you had to do is you had to run a mile and a half in under 12 minutes. And once I was able to accomplish that, then I went on to running some shorter distances and then a marathon. And then I had a crazy boss that, you know, thought that he wanted to run Western States and he couldn't get a qualifier. And that's when I said, oh, I'm gonna finish that qualifier. And I did. That period, that's when I knew running ultras was what I wanted to do. I want to say this. First, I want to say a very big thank you to Ann Trason.
Yes.
Ann, in 1995, which was the year that we went to Winscoten, and we won the gold medal, and we set the world record for the combined time, and she set the world record for the fastest 100K time ever for a woman, which was 7 hours and 47 seconds. I'm sure she wishes many, many times.
Do you remember that?
Oh, God, yes. I'm sure there are times when you thought, I should have not taken that 47-second pee break. But I do want to say this. There was a discussion that I had with Ann before the race. You know, we would talk on the phone every great once in a while, and she was reluctant to join the team because, you know, there's a lot of bull crap political stuff that goes on with a lot of this stuff. And she seemed to be the person who was being targeted a lot. And that was because she didn't want to always play by what they wanted her to do. She wanted to do it her way because her way was the fastest way. And I supported her for doing that. And she really did not at first think that she wanted to be on the team because she knew that there were going to be some pet headbutting going. But I asked her to please be on the team, because more than anything in the world, I wanted to be on that podium and have the national anthem with our hands on our heart because we knew we won that gold medal. And Ann, thank you so much to this day for doing that, because that was one of the proudest, most wonderful things that I was able to achieve in my career with ultra running. And to have you as a teammate along with Donna Perkins is one of my highest privileges and joys ever. So thank you for doing that for me.
Thank you. So you're going to make me cry.
Well, it was an important moment. Lou Payton, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Lou Payton, thank you for putting on the Traveler with your husband, Charlie. My life would not be the life I have right now if it wasn't for the fact that I got to meet you through Susie Cope, which, Susie, you're next on the list, so hang on there, girl. Having the Arkansas Traveler, I ran this race and met my husband in 1995, right after we won the gold medal. And I married my husband at the race in 1996. In 2001, Lou and Charlie Payton decided to that they had been the race director for 10 years for the Traveler and that they were ready to move on. And I still hadn't gotten my 10 Traveler finishes yet, and so I asked her to take over the race. And Stan and I are still the race directors of that race. So it's a combination of, Lou, thank you for you and Charlie for introducing the sport of ultra running to our running community, which out of all of the United States, by far, I believe that we have the tightest-knit ultra running community in any other state in the United States. And for also, of course, when Dave Cowine came up injured, you suggested that Dave get in touch with Stan. And, of course, now, of course, I'm married to Stan. Susie Cope, when I met you, it was at the Nugget 50. And I was all hell-bent for leather, going to have to win Nugget so that I could run Western States. And I ran to the bathroom, and you stopped me and said, girl, you're going to run 50 miles while you run into the bathroom. I stopped and said, who do I have to beat here to win this race? And, of course, you just looked at me and laughed your behind off. And I did end up winning that race, which got me that ticket into Western States. But you didn't just leave it there. You then went to Ray Clark and talked to Ray and said, I met this new girl. Ray got my phone number and called me. And between you, Ray Clark, and Frank Ives, who all believed in me, you made me, all of you, gave me that push that I needed into the career of ultra running that took me places that I never, ever in a million years would have thought I would have been able to go. So thank you so much for doing that. So, I love you all so much for doing that for me. Okay, proudest moments, definitely, as I say, gold medal and setting the world record, which was a wonderful thing, and having the national anthem paid. Stan and I were in 2009. We both finished the Grand Slam in the same year, so we became the first married couple to finish the Grand Slam in the same year. And I'm going to tell you, that in itself was difficult because you weren't just supporting one. Yeah. You had to support both, was hard. And the chances of both finishing, because if you start looking at those odds, they were very, very slim, but we were able to complete it. Now, I do want to talk a little bit about where we're going in ultra running. I believe that in ultra running, when I first started, there were some races. There were only maybe 10 or 11 100-milers. As Anne has said, there's 100 to 200 100-milers now. I don't know. I believe that maybe people have lost focus on what our sport is all about. You know, in 1988 and I believe in 1989, Worldwide Sports came to Western States and said, we want to film this. We want everyone to see what it's like to run 100 miles. And they agreed. But when they came to the board and they said, we want to make this just like running an Ironman. We want to put that money into it. We want to make there be prize money. We want all those things in ultra running that are in triathlons. And the board said no. And the reason they said no was because they didn't want to lose focus on what ultra running was all about. And that wasn't just about winning. It was about making sure that no one died and that people finished the run. And it wasn't how fast did you run it, but it was did you finish it. I believe that in some ways we're losing that focus now and that there are people out there who are more interested in how much money they can make on every race that they put on, not an individual runner itself. They run out of water. They run out of ice. They charge too much. They have 400 or 500 people in a run, which is destroying our trails. It also is putting a huge load on our park system. And some parks and national forces are even turning down runs because they are so abused by our community that they finally say no. So where are we going? I believe there are growing pains and that we're not addressing them as the way that we should be addressing them. And I don't know, I'm not really sure how we can do that because there are people who are more interested in how much money they're going to make on a run than whether or not somebody's going to walk out of this with a good feeling and a good experience like we used to in the 80s and 90s that seems to have gone away. So that's what I have to say.
Chrissy, what year were you born?
I was born in 1960.
And what kind of program did you have at high school or college
sports? We did do the presidential seal when I was in grade school and in the 7th and 8th grade. And then I did not actually run at all until I played tennis, and I was on, believe it or not, I was on the boys' junior varsity baseball team when I was in high school, which was a real big controversy in itself. But I didn't actually start running until 1985.
Mm-hmm. Chrissy, let me interrupt you for a second. This is Susie. I would like you to please tell the people listening what your station is as far as your job.
Oh. I am the captain of the Veterans Affairs Fire Department in North Little Rock, Arkansas.
Boy.
Thank you.
And I have been for, I've been a firefighter for 25 years, and I was promoted to captain, which is actually, I used to tell the guys what to do, but now I get paid to tell the guys what to do. So, and I was promoted to captain
last
year.
Great.
Are you getting him to run?
Yes, I do, actually. Some of them go out and run with me. We actually, on our shift of our guys, we work out every single day at the same time. We go to the gym, and then we either go out and run, we do the Stairmaster, or we do treadmill, and we do it as a team, and then we all eat together at night.
That's great.
This is Sarah May Berman. I am so glad to hear that, because there's nothing more discouraging than seeing fat firefighters.
I agree with you.
Right.
And they are not fat on my shift.
Good. No.
Mr. Chiappelli, Chrissy, I think
that's
great that you're doing it. Mr. Chiappelli from New York. It's great that you're doing that, because I think one of the big problems with fire departments and police departments, after people pass their tests, they just forget the physical nature of their job, and it has a very damaging effect on their aging process and the success of what they do. Years ago, the LAPD had about five runners that were police department guys, and they were also top runners. And they formed a whole big running unit in the department. What was interesting about those years was that was the year when the police were more well-known in the city, had less arrests, had more social services working with the people. There was less racism in the department. It was just an amazing thing that went on because of the fact that 90% of the department were physically fit. And then when these guys finally retired, the whole thing dropped out. And so it's such an important thing as a public servant that when you're physically fit, you function much better with the people that you have to work for. And it's great that you're doing that, and hope it can expand.
Yes.
How does this is Gary? How does the group feel about Chrissy's concerns about the direction of the sport?
Donna Gookin. I agree, and I think she's absolutely right that it'll destroy our trails and our parks if it continues to go in the direction of commercial exploitism. And I would like to see it be like it was, and I think if they want to give money for short races, that's fine. But for the long distance, super long distance, I think to keep it more like it was in the past.
Yes, I agree 100%. And the other problem is look at Leadville. You know, when Ken was the race director with Merrily, you know, yes, they had 400 to 500 runners, but do you know that when Lifetime Fitness took it over, they actually allowed 1,200 runners to run that race.
Yeah.
That was like 2-3 years ago. They got so much bad publicity that they had to scale back and make it a lottery, which still hasn't solved the problem.
No.
So it has not solved
right.
the problem. And they charge, you know, $300-$400 per entry. And that's not even the bike race that they have the week before, where they allow 1,500 to 2,000 runners, I mean bikes, bicyclists on there. That is ruining
right.
the trail system.
I know.
So,
Can I ask you a question? Have the fees to put the race on increased?
No, they actually get the way it works with the federal park, which is what part of Leadville is, they get 5% of the growth. And I know this
only
because
5%,
our race is in the federal area. So that's what they get. They get that percentage.
Okay, well, that means you can control then how much money you make and what you charge. But you know what's happening in many places, many of the towns and the security departments that exist in these places, they want fees themselves what they do. It's no longer an altruistic thing done by the state because you pay taxes. They want an actual set of fees to have the race on. And that increases the entry fees for this, and that makes it very difficult.
It's usually only $50 to $100. Usually those fees are only $50 to $100.
Not in California, because I've put on races. But, you know, I want to predict something. I think that, you know, it depends where the race is, because I work a lot putting on races with different agencies. And it just depends on the agency on how they will and what they look at. The governing agency is what I'm talking about, where you get a permit, on how the trails will be managed. In Marin, for instance, the North Face 50, they have probably over 1,000 people who run it, but if it rains and there's going to be a lot of footsteps and destroy the trails, they cancel the race. Ohlone, which is a race that's been going on for 30 years, yep, 50K, it rained a quarter of an inch on Thursday. The race was on Friday, and they canceled it, which was heartbreaking because I was helping Larry.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but the reason it's brought to new is everyone has to evolve with the times, and you can embrace, that's what I'm doing, embracing that people want to run the trails, and you just have to find a way to work it out. And I've had the privilege with working with some wonderful agencies, and sometimes it's a bitter pill to swallow. Like, I was helping Larry with Ohlone this year, and we had everything up in our website. You know, it's a volunteer staff, don't get paid. Had everything out on it, packed away for the aid stations, had to pack it all back in the truck and take it back to our storage because they canceled the race.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have much more maybe positive. I think it's great that people want to do it, and there's a way to make it right. And I put a lot of belief into, like, working with the state and the federal government and local park districts.
And that may be true that you know, California has evolved a little bit more than other places, because that's not so true in other areas where I've run races. I can tell you, I just did War Eagle, which is a 50K, which is in Arkansas, and it was over 400 people, and it was way too many people that were on a single track trail within a quarter of a mile. They didn't have enough water. They ran out of water. They ran out of ice. They didn't know how many people were on their trail. I mean, there are some issues, but the thing was is that the money didn't just go somewhere. It went into that race director's pocket, you know? And so there are problems there that we need to look at, because that's giving our sport a bad name.
Chrissy, I agree with you.
I think it'll all work out.
I think
the
big problem is that overpopulation.
Yeah, that's true. There's too many people in the world.
The way it's mushrooming growth, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that
I'm not
on you.
I don't want any more out. No, wait, there's got to be something done about
question?
It. Yes.
Hello?
This
is Vince again. Can I ask a question? In the national parks, I know they're trail races. What is wrong with, if there's a weather change, not having a running the race on the roads of the park, which are paved? So the race at least can be held, the people there, and you're not going to damage the trails. I mean, this is a big issue. The damage to the trails is very weather conditioned. And so, but you still have the race and hold it on the roadways of the park that one year. So it's a little harder, and it's not on a trail, but nevertheless it goes on, so the people are there, and it's just called the road race aspect of it. That way people are not frustrated about running. You can hold it, and it doesn't damage the park. Why isn't that alternative ever used?
Well, yeah.
Well, they do for Death Valley. You know, the Badwater race that goes through, I don't know if it's national, but they canceled that, and they just put more strict regulations on it, which a lot of people complain about. But, you know, there's ebbs and flows, there's pendulums, things go around. I always believe that there's a lot of circles. I'm big into circles these days. So we all do different circles and come back to a different place, and things evolve. So you can embrace it and try and deal with the changes that need to be done. And that's what I'm hoping. Right now, Badwater has so many regulations on it that people don't want to run it.
Even in orienteering, they're starting to put more and more orienteering courses are just on trails where you can't go off trail.
Yeah, well, no, it's very difficult because of the population increase. Is there still a national committee that overruns ultra running anymore?
I don't know.
We used to have an ultra running committee that was in AAU and also in TAC and any other and whatever the USTAF that is now. That doesn't exist anymore. Annually a way to meet and help to solve these problems. That disappeared. That's pretty terrible.
You know, you're giving AAU a lot more credit than it deserves, if you ask me. Because that wasn't.
Amen.
That was not a very well. It was not voted on. It was a bunch of people just promoting themselves. So,
yeah, that was a little
democracy. Yeah, so I know what it was. We gave it as much power as we could give it in the long distance committee, and it helped helped organize the race. And we tried to get as much money to it as we could. And we were limited by certain politics, but nevertheless, the meetings were very important in helping the growth and also coming to common. Decisions on what a race should be like and the criteria upon which a race would be judged acceptable. And then you want to lose that. That's a very important aspect of this thing, and it helps then not only the race directors, it helps the places where the races are, knowing that there's a pattern, a set of a criteria that are being followed and that are consistent nationwide. And this is very important to know. I'm surprised that died out, but... I had to step out of this whole thing years ago. I couldn't do anything about it.
There is still a committee. The USATF has maybe an ultra trail committee.
Yeah,
something like
committee.
Yeah. Yeah. Roy Perung, he was going to be on the call, but he had a meeting or something. So there is a mechanism or a body to address these. What is the answer? I mean, in terms of these issues you have, what does the group feel is the answer? And also, are there? My understanding is there's very few road ultras these days. It's more sport has definitely moved to trails. Is that correct?
It seems to be more so on trail than road now. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that a lot of what you're talking about having. Committee decide. I think as a race director, and also Chrissy as a race director, we have to live with the races we put on. And I try and emulate what Norm Klein did for volunteers and the dedication that he did for Western States. So it's very dependent upon what kind of person you are and what kind of race you want to put on.
Right.
So
there's really nothing. You know, the problem is that you know you're going to have those people like myself. And you, which are those people that try to emulate what Norm did in the past, and to keep that, you know, that pride that we have as ultra runners. But then there is those people that it's just like when adventure racing was really big. You know, they're out there to make a quick dollar because it's super popular right now, and it gives the sport a bad name. And there really isn't a whole lot we can do about that. Exactly. And the problem is that they don't have to follow anybody's rules, you know, because there are different governing bodies. There's track and field. There's RRCA. There's people who choose not to have either one of those, and they're just on their own, and they're their own entity, and they don't answer to anybody. So what Susie Cope said about picking and choosing is very true.
Who's Norm Klein?
Norm Klein was the race director of Western States. From Ann, what was the years he was race director?
You know, I don't know. I just saw Norm. I go and have lunch with him. You know, the thing that Norm did, and people don't give him credit for, the volunteerism that we have in any of the ultras would never have happened if he didn't. I mean, Wasatch was the one that implemented volunteer hours to get in. But Norm took it to a different level. And then what he did was he really appreciated his volunteers. And that's something I take to heart. And that isn't done a lot. It's... So I think someone who I'd like to write, even I've had this little crazy little article, column for Ultra Running Now, but one of the things I really want to do before I die is to interview Norm Klein, because people, the new generation, really have no idea what he did to cement this, the ultra 100 mile and just ethics with a lot of people and getting people out to do the volunteer and how you treat your volunteer as well. Those are the people who make the races. It's not the runners. It's the volunteers.
Oh, well, definitely. You can have 100 runners. You don't have any volunteers, you have no race.
Well, I'm a volunteer race director.
But remember,
we live in a different time.
Yes. We're living in a different time.
I don't know.
Too many people.
And I didn't take a penny for it. I just took what Dick Collins did. He was another great man. And it's Ann Tracy. Sorry. I think a lot
of people. Yeah, it was nice when it was back in the days and we could just charge 25 cents and have a card table for the aid station. But now, because there's more and more and more and more people, you can't do that. And so a lot of these commercial people are using volunteers to do all these aid stations, and then they're making a lot of money.
Well, we running has evolved into these problems of the large sizes and necessitates income. And with income, it's hard to get volunteers in many places because there's money around. And the psychology of running, of those who administer, has changed too, very drastically. And thus, people want to use it as a tool for money making, and that also can't be helped. So therefore, what has to be done is some way to get all these people involved in some oversight of the program, where you can then at least find a consistent way to put these races on, even if there's money involved. What that money is used for. But without that, it's all individual things going on, and there's no control of anything, and then the sport gets denigrated because people have to complain. We can't go back to all volunteer things. That doesn't exist anymore. But there are many people who will volunteer for the day just for the fun of it, but others end up getting paid. So, and as you build the numbers that you're building up, it becomes very difficult without a consistent staff setting up these races to get them on and get everything organized. So it's a part of the evolution of something getting bigger. And by the way, ultra running, getting to that state is one way a horrible thing, another way a proud thing. Because look at all these people who are out there trying to do it. You know, it's a mixed bag here. But some way, the people that are involved have got to organize together to try to set up a credit criteria. And everybody in the end, some people will gripe, but most people in the end will say, great, we can follow a set of procedures, okay, that gives us the recognition of putting the race on, and they're consistent, and then we don't make it hard for the runner, we don't make it hard for the person putting it on, and for the parks or the areas that are allowing us to run.
This is Sarah Mae Berman. My husband and I and other club members of ours help out at the race up Mount Washington. This is a race up the auto route. It's a very short distance, but it is one steady hill up. Club members who help provide waivers for other club members who want to do the run, because there is a limit. I think the limit this year was, I don't know, 1,000 or 1,200 runners, and it's a very desirable run. It's a challenge, you know, and so that there's a lottery, and you have to get a place from winning in the lottery. But if you have club members who help out, then you can get places. You know, more waivers for your club members.
Good idea. I'm going to have to leave the conversation, but I've enjoyed it very much. Hope we can do it again. Thank you, Gary.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. We'll wind down in a couple minutes. Just any last thoughts regarding just the direction of the sport and some of the things that been anyone
I just want to ask. Sarah Mae Berman, mm-hmm. I just want to ask if anybody has any trouble with mountain bikes in on their trails.
Sure. Yes. But, you know,
it's
a lot of times...
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's a struggle. You know, a lot of times on race day, what we'll do is we'll put up signs saying, you know, mountain bikes, please yield to runners on this day, because we have to pull a permit, and of course we've got permission from, you know, the governing body, which it be the state park or whether it be the federal government, that, you know, we paid to use those trails for that day. And a lot of the mountain bike people, they're not happy about it. I do know that when their turn comes that they're on the trail, you know, I would like to think that the runners would do the same, you know, either not run that day on the trail or yield to the mountain bikers so that they have the right to the trail. I have not been on a trail with a mountain bike race going on. I do know that if it was me, I would yield. If there are signs saying, hey, we've pulled the permit today. Actually, I think I would probably say I'm not going to run on this trail today because I don't want to interfere with the race. But there are people with the mentality that it doesn't matter whether or not, you know, a permit's been pulled or not. They're not going to yield. They're just going to keep going. And it does cause problems. And it causes a lot of animosity between runners and mountain bikers.
One of the things we've noticed is that we have orienteering maps on parks and forests around the greater Boston area. And the Middlesex Fells, which is about 5 miles north of Boston, near, obviously, lots of urban housing, they attract a lot of mountain bikes who go out too early in the spring and ruin the trails, uncover roots, go out when the ground isn't properly defrosted and dried out. And so we get limited from using this area because the mountain bikes ruin it.
Mm-hmm.
This is Susie. There's another aspect that you're possibly overlooking, and that is the horse traffic. And certainly I'm sure Ann can jump in on this because we have that issue not only when I was first running ultras in California, but now I'm in Texas and I started a 50-mile race here that is in its 14th year now, and we have horse traffic as well as mountain bike traffic, and all I can say is rules and regulations aren't going to fix it. It requires common sense, and that's a real shortage right now.
And if you're running and you land
park.
In one of those meadow muffins.
But doesn't the park enforce your permit for the trail?
No.
It depends on the park.
To, it's part of the law. The law of the park. I mean, the park to be a permit
park.
Gives you that legal right. And why don't they keep these people off?
You know, what I have to say is I always think of California being a leader in a lot of ways, and I think a lot of these issues are being thought of. And, you know, it's just part of the evolution of having people enjoy more of the outside. I mean, you could be like my nieces and nephews and play video games all day, or you could be outside enjoying it. So I'm hoping that these issues do become forefront, and generally, what it takes is some sort of calamity to happen, but I do feel mm-hmm. that these issues will be addressed, and it'll be better for all of us. And instead of having some big general governing body being decided for everyone, I think at a local level, knowing what your parks are like, and working well with those agencies is the best approach, and that's what I do with the little run I'm putting on now with California State. They have a special permit person, and we're starting to have more and more races that cross rivers because the race I'm putting on crosses the Western States course where the horses cross, not where the runners cross, and there are some legitimate issues with river crossings, and it's good. I applaud that they want to further discussions and make it safe. So,
you run through the water?
I think it's all good. Yeah, we have a big, well, Western States always did, so there's a poverty bar where the horses cross, and I put on a little, last year was my first year, it's a little 50K, but yeah, we want to make it safe. And
you run through the water?
Well, you go across and you're gorded, at least at the Overlook, what I put on. Gordy Ainsley is going to help assist people across. There's a rope. And
okay.
Yeah. But
your feet get wet.
Rivers before. Oh, yeah. You get up to. Oh, yeah. Especially if you're short. This year in the States, I think they went a little overboard. They made everyone wear life jackets, even the safety people. So the safety people, the runners had to. These are discussions. It's just an example, I think, of where when it becomes more popular, it can be more safer for people.
Remember, there's different groups. I'm sorry, guys.
Sorry.
Should I say something?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Vince. Mm-hmm.
The different groups I'm finding do not have any organized way in which they communicate with people who are involved in their sport. This is particularly true of biking. If you're not a bike racer, you're not involved with anything that has rules. And the majority of people out biking, even in the trails, biking and so forth, are independent people who just do what they want. And that necessitates really for the supplier of the trail to have rules and to enforce them. Because most bikers are not involved in what biking is all about from a racing point of view. And they really don't care what you want to do and so forth. And we've had this problem here in New York. We just had to insist that the parks themselves get involved with the control, because if someone gets killed, and it's very possible on those trails, it's going to affect the park itself, and so it just can't be let go. And that's why
do they have enough personnel to do that?
About the government doing something, the park must take responsibility with you on these events. Otherwise, there's going to be some tragic stuff going on the way these people ride.
Do they have enough personnel to do that, the parks?
Well, the point is, though, you have to enter the park with your equipment somewhere, right? Don't you have to report you're going on the trail as a biker?
No.
No, you don't. And now, when there's an event, are there any signs that say there's an event going on that these trails are restricted?
I put on this race last year, and I had to put up signs to warn the miners. Mm-hmm. Because part of Western States, I went back, it was longer last year, 100K. I had to put up signs because there might be some person going down a single track trail who had a mining claim.
Yeah.
So, yes, when you work with the feds, and I had to take it seriously. You don't mess with the feds. I had to put all these signs on Western States course that said, race happening, and I had to let them know a week ahead of time. And this is, like, really in the middle of nowhere. I'm not kidding. And I was thinking I was crazy by having... And then you have to take him down. So, it was... a lot of these agencies do put a lot of thought into it, and the Tahoe National Forest really does. They don't allow a lot of races on the Pacific Crest Trail, for example, near Squaw. Western States crosses it, but no event is allowed to be on the Pacific Crest Trail there used to be a race between Donner Summit, for example, and Squaw Valley. So, there are a lot of good people that do think about these things, and I just want to say it's not all bad.
No, it's not all bad.
No, the difficulty
is
the erratic incident.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, this is Chrissy, and I have another meeting I have to go to in about 15 minutes,
sure.
So I'm going to have to cancel out.
Okay, thank you. And I'm going to stop the recording now, so everyone hang on 1 second.